Hello. Hi.
Tape is rolling.
Oh, the tape is rolling. Okay, here we go.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Kathy Bernard.
I'm Barbara Klein.
Thanks so much for tuning in. First, from a New York City apartment to a small house in Vermont, one empty nester tells her story. Next, first aid and fundamentals for survival. We should all be up to date.
The mental fog is commonly called chemo brain.
Plus, the 11th architect of the Capitol and 64 million square feet of duty.
And we'll shoot the breeze about the contests that help one man change the way he lives.
Here's a scenario some of us can relate to. After sending her only child off to college, Lynn Darling was left at a crossroads. One part of her life was ending and another beginning. She was lost and was faced with what is commonly called empty nest syndrome.
Feeling adrift, Lynn decided to relocate from a New York City apartment to a small house in the middle of the Vermont woods to figure it all out. Her circuitous and sometimes hilarious story of getting lost and eventually being found is chronicled in her memoir, Out of the Woods. We're delighted to have her join us on the phone. Welcome to the program, Lynn.
Oh, thank you so much.
I think it's fair to say that many of us midlifers dream of escaping, maybe occasionally, you know, maybe sometimes more than that, but most of us don't act on it. So what made you leave your life in New York City and go off to Vermont to live sort of in the middle of nowhere?
It's a very good question. In fact, it actually seemed to me like a pretty normal thing to do until I would tell people what I was planning and they would look at me with concern and say, why? I think for me, it was the only way I could figure out what came next. I think we all go through crossroads in our life, and you never know which one's going to be the one that really gets to you. It could be, in my case, it was sparked in partly by my daughter's graduation from high school. It could be losing a job. It could be a divorce. But we get to these points where we suddenly, it's as if we threw all the entire deck of cards in the air and thought, who the hell is going to pick these up? Who am I now? Who is the person living this life? I just found that everything that I thought I knew about myself I had questions about being a writer, being a mother. I'd been a widow for a long time. I had no idea what, if anything, I wanted from love and romance. The city just seemed like a kind of scary place to be if you had no particular dream that you were following. I think I went to ground sort of like an animal goes to ground when it's wounded. I needed a place to be alone. And I'd always had this fantasy of getting finally, at some point in my life, a sense of direction. I love wandering in the woods, but I literally get lost crossing the street. I mean, I've been lost in parking lots, in city parks, you name it. And I thought if I went to the woods where I'd be forced to have to figure out how to use a map and a compass, what I learned about direction might give me a clue as to what I wanted out of life.
So, Lynn, it wasn't difficult to really, did you have family in the area, you know, to pick up and leave? You really did kind of throw it all to the wind.
More than I even realized. I had no family. I moved into a house. I had had a sudden windfall a number of years before, and I bought this house because it was the only one I could afford and because it was isolated. And by isolated, I mean up a mile of deeply rutted dirt road, which was sort of more of a Jeep trail than it was. It doesn't even appear on some maps. The house was falling down. It had been built by an elderly couple who had never built a house before, so it was a little eccentric in many ways. I kind of liked the fact that I was moving to a place where nobody really knew who I was, because that's pretty much how I felt about me, too. So whatever I came up with, I wouldn't be fighting it against what people thought they knew about me. I was going to be sort of figuring it out from the ground up.
So did you just uproot and leave everything and everyone you knew in New York City and go to Vermont?
Pretty much. I mean, as we know, it's not as drastic a thing to do in the 21st century as it was before. I mean, I had a telephone line, which worked whenever the beavers didn't chew it to pieces, and a computer that worked occasionally when the antenna was blowing in the right direction. So I did stay in touch. You know, I would, when my daughter was on vacation and wanted to go back to New York, I would join her. So I wasn't like off being some kind of hairy bearded hermit at the top of the tower, you know, speaking in tongues or anything. Although I was afraid toward the end of the time I was in Vermont, I was getting close to that. But mostly I was just sort of on my little hill and trying to figure out how to make a fire and take care of myself. But it wasn't as bleak as it sounds. I mean, there's good people up there, and you have to have a sense of humor when you move to a place where you don't know how anything works. But apart from that, I'm very good at asking people for help. They all thought I was crazy, but that. Another story.
Yeah. But Lynn, you know, I noticed that you dubbed your house Castle Dismal. And I'm just wondering, I mean, coming from New York City, did you know a lot about like home repairs and, you know, septic tanks and weeds on steroids and all that?
Absolutely nothing. That was the thing. I would call in people to help. Like, it was off grid, this house. So there was no electricity that didn't come from the solar panels, which were very old and not working most of the time. You know, so I'd call in a solar panel guy from the local company, and he'd show me how it all works, and then at the end he would look at me and say, "You're living here by yourself? That's very brave." And then I would call in the guy with the wood stove to show me how a wood stove works, and he would explain that, and he would tell me I was very brave. And then finally one day I went to see the real estate agent who had sold me the house, and she was trying to ask me if I wanted to buy any of her mulch. And I was such a city person, I didn't even know what mulch was. And I wanted to fake it, but I couldn't even fake it. I just burst out in tears. It was just like the final last thing I didn't know. And I said, "I don't even know what mulch was." And I said, "Why do people..." I finally confessed to her how lost I felt. And I said, "Look, everyone's telling me I'm brave. Why are they telling me that?" And she said, "Oh, you have to understand, in Vermont, brave is polite for crazy."
Well, it's great.
I kind of named it Castle Dismal because it was, when I first moved up there, I had this, now that I look at it, kind of embarrassing fantasy that this would be my fortress of solitude, and I'd be like Superman in the comics in the 50s, and this would be where I would go to heal, and I would figure out how to be old, and I would figure out how to be alone and self-sufficient. But finally, I ended up, I realized how miserable I was, which I think is a stage in learning who you really are. You kind of finally have to admit how all your old maps aren't working before you can make a new one.
Well, Lynn, you apparently are quite a list maker, and you have two lists. We read one was list practical, which we kind of understand, like maybe doing the laundry and grocery shopping or whatever, mm-hmm. and the other list metaphysical. Fill us in on that one.
Well, let's see. I don't have the list in front of me, but as I remember, it was something like, learn how to be old. Deal with sex, find my real self, and learn Latin. The idea was that I was starting this whole new part of my life. I was no longer young, but I wasn't really old. I had no idea whether I even wanted to fall in love again, and if I did, how I would go about it. And I thought that if I just sort of sat up there long enough, I would... I'd be able to figure out these big, big questions. Now, as you probably figured out, I didn't really come up with any great answers to any of them. But, you know, just asking the questions and really thinking about what was important to me and what I could live with and what I could live without, and mostly how to deal with who I had been and get rid of all of the stuff, you know, all of that stuff we put in the attics of our memories about the mistakes we made and the regrets we have. If I could just clear that stuff out, I could make a little room for a future. And that did happen.
Well, Lynn, let me ask you about one of those items on your metaphysical list, which was sex. How did you even handle that? Because I read that you tried online dating in Vermont.
Right. Actually, you know, you're the first person to ask me that question, and I'm very surprised nobody else has, so good for you. Well, I had gone up there, and I decided I was done with sex. I was in my 50s. I just figured I wanted to be kind of like, I'd read about, okay, I should explain, I'm not a jock and I don't know much about sports, but I'd read about Wayne Gretzky and how he had retired from hockey, where he had been considered one of the best players, and that he really wanted to go out of the game before he got pathetic. And I thought, that's how I want to get out of sex and dating. I want to get out before, I want to retire honorably before people start finding me, you know, start calling me mutton dressed as lamb like they do in Britain. And I just didn't want to be one of those desperate women who feel like if they don't have a man, they're going to, you know, there's, they have no self-worth. I think what you want from dating and from sex changes as you get older. I had been a wife. I had been a mother. I'd had a great marriage. So I wasn't out there really to sort of prove anything. I did know that the flirtation and the hunt and the feeling of being wanted by somebody wasn't the same as when I was younger, where all that stuff just made me feel really cool. I wanted somebody who I could really talk to, and I needed
a companion.
A companion, exactly. But before I could have that, I sort of had to get my own house in order. And I realized that there were worse things than being lonely. I mean, lonely's like the flu. Being lonely can be like the flu. You have a really intense case of it. You feel like, oh my God, I'm never going to be happy again. But then it goes away, you know, and I realized I needed to get in touch with the bigger world, not just the world of who thinks I'm still pretty, but more the world around me. And I just began to take these long, long walks, and just the kind of grandeur of the outside world, the getting outside of myself, kind of temporarily cured me of needing romance for a while.
Well, Lynn, just when it seemed like you were really starting to acclimate to your new world out there, you were diagnosed with breast cancer. You know, that really must have come, you know, that's hard and what a challenge. And how did you even begin to cope with that one?
Well, in a way, I know this sounds weird, but I have to say I feel like I got lucky. At the time it happened, I was in this swamp of self-pity and, you know, feeling sorry for myself and a kind of lassitude. I missed my daughter. I had no work I wanted to do. I couldn't figure out why I was getting up in the morning. Well, nothing like a diagnosis of a life-threatening disease to make you sort of really come to attention. And for me, I think part of it was just, I'm trying to explain this to you because it sounds a little weird, but cancer became a kind of microcosm of all the changes one goes through as you get older. You know, you go through treatment and your appearance changes. Your hair falls out. Often you gain weight because the breast cancer chemo for some reason does make people do that. Your skin doesn't look the same. You get used to the idea that this self that you thought you knew is very, very open to change. And I got through it mostly by kind of just realizing how much it had to teach me, if that doesn't sound too stupid. I remember one day looking at a reflection of myself in the window in the living room, and what I saw was this bald man with glasses on, a fat, bald, pale-skinned man with huge glasses. It was me, of course, but I didn't recognize my face, and I called that person Augustus Egg after a painter I had read about because it looked like an egg. My face looked egg-shaped. And Augustus Egg was the one who got me through it because he became my persona for all the anger and the fear and the weirdness I was feeling. But he also led me to this place where I found the person who was underneath all the people I had been as a wife and as a mother and as a writer, you know, the coquette, the flirt, the maternal person, all these roles we adopt as women. Underneath all of them, I found the person who was none of those things, was just the being that wanted to live. And getting down to that, to this idea of, I don't care. I don't care what the future brings. I just want to be alive, was this huge shock to me. I realized just how fierce my love of life was. And that made me fight. And that made me go through it, and at the end of it, I was deeply, deeply grateful for all of the stuff it made me just get rid of.
And you ultimately found yourself?
I found this sort of genderless being, this little frail, fr- frightened, vulnerable person, or being really, not even a person, who just wanted to live, who wanted to live without anxiety and without self-consciousness. And I try to hold on to that memory of just what it was like to just want to be alive to get to the next day, because ultimately, by channeling her, I was able to find someone to actually teach me a sense of direction, to remember that life isn't there to just sort of stew about the mistakes you made and the regrets you have. It's there to be in the present moment, and it kept me in the present. It really did, just that sense of wanting to get to know that person again, the one I was before I turned into a girl.
And real quickly, Lynn, are you still living in Vermont in the middle of the woods?
No, I'm not. After my daughter graduated from college, I had to finally admit that I was really, really tired of being on my own. Not lonely, but that solitude had only so much to teach me, and I wanted to be back in a city to have a community, to have people to talk to have streets to roam around. So I moved back to New York.
Well, Lynn Darling, author of Out of the Woods, a memoir of wayfinding, we babes just love your story. It's almost like Eat, Pray, and Love, but set in Vermont.
And older but wiser.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Whether you're hiking the Himalayas, miles from help, or suddenly caught in a city disaster, every second counts in a medical emergency. Bottom line, we should arm ourselves with knowledge and supplies to save someone's life or our own.
Dr. James Hubbard is a survival skills expert and a seasoned family physician. He's also the publisher of the popular website, thesurvivaldoctor.com, and the author of First Aid Fundamentals for Survival. Dr. Hubbard joins us from Colorado. Welcome, doctor.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you write that there are two problems with medical emergencies. One, you never know when they're coming. And two, you don't know what kind of health threat they'll cause. So how do we even begin to prepare for an emergency?
Well, I think there's a couple of ways for that. Number one is mentally. And the problem with that is that because you never know it's coming, that you go into this panic mode initially, and, you know, I mean, I've seen people in the office that have you know, fairly minor injuries or whatever, and they just forget what to do, and those first few minutes, like you said, may save a life. Second thing is to memorize a few common things. I mean, no matter what the disaster is, some of the things that might happen are more common than others, such as a wound. If you see a wound, you need to make sure that you know the first thing you do if it's bleeding a lot is stop the bleeding, and that's obvious, but I've seen it so many times people don't do that. And the simple way to stop most bleeding is by applying pressure. 90% of the time, all you have to do is, if you don't have any gloves, get you some plastic or something to a barrier. Don't worry about infection at that stage. Just stop the bleeding, and pressure usually works. If not, a tourniquet is easy to use. Yes, it is. It can be dangerous, but when you're talking about stopping someone from bleeding to death, it's certainly worth it, and you should know how to use a tourniquet, I think.
And, Doctor, let me ask you about the tourniquet, because I never was sure whether you put it above or below the wound. Where do you put the tourniquet?
You put it above. The heart is pumping out the blood in the arteries. The arteries are what's going to cause the big blood loss really quickly. There's going to be some spurting or a lot of blood coming out. Say you had one in your wrist or your forearm, you'd put the tourniquet on your biceps area, upper arm. You put it closest to the chest or the trunk that you can.
Well, now, doctor, if we could only pack, say, three things in our survival bag, what should they be?
You know what? If I had three things to pack, I think I would. You can makeshift so many things. Like I think I would have a duct tape.
You sound like my husband.
You can make a tourniquet, close wounds. You can do so many things. I think you should have some sort of knife. Our scissors are just safety pins. Safety pins are so convenient for so many things. You can make them where you could fish with them. You can make a sling by just simply bringing your shirt, the bottom of your shirt, up above your arm and pinning it there. If you needed to, you know, you could dig out a little foreign body or something like that. And another thing that I love is honey. honey has antibacterial properties, so you can eat it. It's studied proof that it has antibacterial properties, so you could put it on a wound. It not only will prevent infection, but it'll also a lot of times treat infection. There's a lot of studies that show different ways of why it does that. Raw honey is what you need. And another honey that's been studied a lot that has a lot of antibacterial properties is Manuka honey, M-A-N-U-K-A honey, and you can buy that as a New Zealand honey. Or Medi honey, you can actually get that in a little tube, and it has a lot of antibacterial properties. The only thing about honey is don't put it on children under about two or so. In small children, has been shown there can be a little bacteria in some of the raw honeys, and it's never hurt anybody and never caused any problems in adults that we know of. But in children, they're so small, you know, under two, that if they were to ingest very much of it, it has caused actually some dangerous problems with them.
If you've just joined us, this is Barb and Kathy, the two Boomer Babes, and we're speaking with Dr. James Hubbard about how to prepare for the unexpected accident and maybe save our life or someone else's. Well, Doctor, let's talk about a few things that we should always have at our home, okay? What happens if a little child ingests something that they should not ingest? Is there an antidote that we should always have on hand?
I would have on hand the number for one of the toxicology poison control centers, because sometimes you want to give Epicac, but a lot of times you don't. And Epicac is something you can get. I think it's I-P-E-C-A-C. You can get over-the-counter, I believe, and it will induce vomiting. A lot of times what you want to do, though, is just have them drink a lot of fluids and a lot of milk and try to dilute it as much as you can. And, of course, get them medical help. The problem with inducing vomiting in a lot of these people is some of these poisons are very corrosive. So if you induce the vomiting, you're running the risk of injury coming back up into the the esophagus and into the throat and even possibly get down into the lungs.
Okay, so always call poison control, you said?
I would have that number handy. I would have it available. Okay. That's one of those things that you need to have, you know. I mean, you need to be prepared, and it's so easy. Just find poison control number. If you don't know the number, call the hospital, your local hospital emergency room, and ask them what number to call, or you can look it up online.
Perfect. Okay, now, Doctor, for the more adventurous types, say, that maybe perhaps join the Peace Corps or travel to, you know, far corners of the earth, and often to places with poor water supplies, what should they pack?
You can go to one of the wilderness stores or one of the outdoor stores or something like that, and you can get you some little chlorine tablets or something that says that it takes care of water, disinfects water. The main thing that I would do is use some sort of chlorine, and if you don't have the tablets or so, you can use household chlorine. Unscented chlorine, you just got to know how much to use. You can use iodine if you're not allergic to that. And boiling is fantastic. It's really the best way to get rid of the bacteria and the parasites and everything. One other thing you might consider is having one of the good microfilter type cups or drinking bottles on hand. They may be $20, $30 or something like that for one. And they have in there, they have these little micropores that filter out at least the protozoa and a lot of the bacteria. And then they also, a lot of them have a little activated charcoal in there, which filters out a lot of the other things. Viruses are really small, so they're hard to filter out. Boiling is the best way to take care of that.
Well, Doctor, with summer just around the corner, I mean, there's potential hazards lurking, and this is my paranoia, in our gardens or even in the woods. So say we're bitten by a poisonous spider, or we even have copperheads in my neck of the woods. What should we do first?
You know, first thing is don't panic. Easy to say. If I get bit by a snake, I'm not sure what I would do. But the good news is a lot of the spiders are not going to cause a lot of problems. A lot of the snakes, even if they're a poisonous or venomous snake, a lot of times they don't have enough venom to cause problems. But sometimes they do, yes. The only thing you can do, the only treatment that's really going to help with that is get to medical help, because sucking out the venom hasn't ever been proven to help, and you might cause more damage, and your mouth's full of bacteria, so you might cause more bacteria and an infection.
Yuck. Okay, because you always see that on TV shows.
Exactly.
The knife, and they suck out that venom.
Well, I'd say you'd have to really be up on how to restart a heart, because I'd be having a heart attack if I came into contact with a big spider or a snake.
Yeah, some need antivenom, a lot don't. It's better to get to the doctor as quickly as you can. The less activity you can do, the better, but obviously you got to see which one is worse, the activity or not getting to the doctor. So if you have to be active, get to the doctor is the thing. There are only a couple of spiders that cause problems around here other than a little bit of reaction or a possible infection, and that's brown recluse. You need to know what that looks like, and you need to know about black widow spiders. Even if you don't see them, and sometimes you don't, they have some characteristics that you can learn about that'll tell you, well, this may very well be one and I need to get to the doctor.
Dr. James Hubbard, survival expert and author of First Aid, Fundamentals for Survival, thanks so much for this first aid refresher and for joining the Two Boomer Babes.
You're welcome. Glad to do it.
Up next, chemo brain and what patients can do about it.
For years, cancer patients have worried about, joked about, and been frustrated by the mental cloudiness they sometimes notice with treatment. The mental fog is commonly called chemo brain. The brain usually recovers over time, but the sometimes vague yet distressing mental changes can affect everyday life for many people going through it.
Matt LeBlanc is an oncology nurse with a cancer rehabilitation program at Anne Arundel Medical Center in Annapolis, Maryland. Earl Shellner was a patient in the program. They join us on the phone to talk about the phenomenon of chemo brain and what patients can do about it. Welcome to the program, Matt and Earl.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Matt, let's start with you. Sure. What exactly is chemo brain?
So chemo brain, like you eloquently stated, is sort of a mental fogginess that can affect people's concentration, their word finding, their memory, or their reasoning ability. It's actually a brain injury that's caused by cancer or its treatments. You know, it's similar to other types of brain injury like that you might be more familiar with, like a traumatic brain injury or injury from a stroke. It can be caused by chemotherapies. Radiation to the face and the brain, some hormonal therapies, as well as tumors in the brain themselves.
So you're saying that chemo brain isn't necessarily just caused by chemotherapy. It could be because you're having radiation or other therapies?
Yeah, exactly. So the understanding of this phenomenon is growing all the time. And the sort of terminology now that's used in the medical field is cancer or cancer treatment-related cognitive impairment. And that sort of encompasses the scope of the many different ways that your brain can be affected as you're moving through your cancer journey or your cancer treatment.
So how common is it?
There's a range that research sort of reports. Anywhere from 15 to 70% is reported in research. In our own population at Anne Arundel Medical Center, we did a survey trying to assess many different cancer and cancer treatment-related symptoms, and about 40% of our patient population reported some type of cognitive impairment. So that's not a very clear answer, but definitely very, very prevalent.
And it's a lot of PES, very common.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, Earl, you're a cancer survivor, congratulations, and a patient in Matt's program. Briefly tell us what you experienced with chemo brain.
Okay, yeah, like I'm saying, it's something that we were just figuring out things for, but what I was experiencing, it was the day I finished my chemo treatment. It was my last day. I came home and I wanted to make copies of my little certificate saying I finished chemo, and I wanted to send it out to my relatives. And I sat down and I couldn't remember how to make a cursive F or a cursive J, things like that. I actually had to open up my computer laptop and go to a website that showed how to do cursive writing just to write those letters. And that's when I realized something was going on, and I asked my mom and my friends, and they told me, yeah, man, we didn't want to say anything, but you'll tell a story, and then 10 minutes later you'll tell us the same story, or you're using words incorrectly. And that's when we were afraid the cancer spread to the brain, but luckily it didn't. And that's when they referred me over to Matt and Rebecca, saying that, hey, we think this will help you out a lot for the chemo brain treatment there, the cognitive treatment.
Earl, did you notice any personality changes with chemo brain?
Well, it did turn changed my personality a great deal once I realized what I was doing. It was pretty traumatic, actually, because I didn't even go out for New Year's Eve for a party I was invited to because I was afraid to be around people because I didn't know if I would speak incorrectly or tell the same story. So I started ducking phone calls and everything. It was it's very stressful and it's weird. It's something you can't imagine when you lose your brain and you don't are able to do things like you used to, and especially when you don't even realize it. That just made me have all new respect for Alzheimer's and things like that because it's something you would never want to experience. So I'm so glad they had something like this for this therapy to help me out.
And it sounds like it could be extremely depressing, too, which raises
another hole. My doctor actually had to up my anxiety meds and everything like that to get me in, help me out with some sleeping pills because it was just gnawing on me because that was something I was able to do. Especially when I was managing for Chili's, I always used to have to do employees with my meetings and things like that. And the same thing when I did the IT work. I was just so used to speaking to everyone in groups and things like that. And that ability just stopped. Like I said, I was ducking phone calls and things like that. I wasn't going out or anything like that to celebrate the end of chemo. So.
And Earl, how old are you, can I ask?
I just turned 40 in February, on February 19th. So.
Oh, so you're a young guy.
Yeah, when I was diagnosed, I was only 38. I just turned 38, actually. And I was diagnosed in January, and I turned 38 in February. So I was actually diagnosed at 37.
Oh. Well, Matt, let me ask you, are there treatments available for chemo brain?
Yeah, there are a couple of things that we have to offer that can be very helpful. So what we set Earl up with and what we set up a lot of other patients up with is cognitive rehabilitation, which is usually done by a speech-language pathologist. And me and Earl were just talking actually earlier that sometimes surprises people because they immediately think of speech pathologists working with speech impediments, but they do a wide range of things from cognitive rehab to swallowing therapy, and they also work with speech impediments as well. There's a couple strategies that our speech therapists use with people that have cognitive impairments, whether it's from chemotherapy or from a stroke or from a brain injury. The first one is they do some education about compensatory strategies. So, you know, helping you to get organized so that you can kind of compensate for any kind of deficits or impairments that you might be experiencing. And the second strategy, there's exercises that are designed to improve your areas of weakness. So they start by doing a pretty comprehensive assessment of your strengths and weaknesses in cognitively. And there's a series of exercises that they can go through, word games, memory games. And literally what you're doing is you are creating new pathways in your brain to access information that's still there but that you might be having difficulty accessing. And so through repetition, you're actually building new pathways in your brain to, you know, restore function.
Well, finally, Earl, was your participation in the cancer rehab program at Anne Arundel, was it helpful?
Oh, it was extremely helpful. I mean, and I could actually notice the difference within after that first five or six sessions because my friends were telling me, I had them tell me if I was ever repeating myself. And gradually, I could tell just that quickly in a couple of months that they were saying it less and less that I was doing things like that. And like one of the things that Matt was talking about here for the organization, I actually couldn't remember my neighbor's kid's name. And I've known him for 14 years since he was in her womb. But what it is, his name was Jason. So what I did was I remembered a calendar. And in the calendar, you have Jason for July, August, September, October, November. So that way, whenever I saw him, I'd say, okay, think of the calendar, think of how the calendar works, those middle months. Oh, yeah, his name is Jason. So those are the kind of things they teach you in the program, and it helped out tremendously. And the numbers that came through Rebecca, I was up so many percentage points from there. So you can not only tell your difference yourself, you can actually see the difference in the actual numbers there from the results.
Oh, that's terrific. I'm going to use that, Jason. Never thought about that before.
Right, the mind pegs.
Yeah, that's terrific.
Yeah, well, I don't know where I got that from, but it just popped in my head.
It works.
I looked at the calendar, I saw that it spelled out Jason. I was like, I wonder if they did that on purpose or named kids after that. I'm not sure, but just something I use.
Very smart.
Well, Matt LeBlanc, oncology nurse with the Cancer Rehabilitation Program at Anne Arundel Medical Center in Annapolis, Maryland, and Earl Schellner, a participant in the program, thanks so much for sharing this very important info with the two Boomer Babes. And Earl, we're so happy you're much better.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Yeah, it's a great day. Just found out 3 weeks ago, so it's great.
Congrats to you. And Matt, thanks for all your help with all your patients.
Oh, thank you for having us on.
Inspiring. Some boomers have really cool jobs. Take Stephen Ayers, for example, who is the current architect of the Capitol, only the 11th person to hold that job since George Washington laid the Capitol cornerstone in 1793.
We are delighted to have him in our studio to tell us about the gig and what it's like to be a true steward of history. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here, and I do have a cool job.
You do. You really do. So tell us what are the responsibilities of this really cool job? What does the architect of the Capitol do?
Well, I think most importantly is that I am the steward of the beautiful treasures, these beautiful buildings that are on Capitol Hill that have been entrusted to my care and this team of great employees that that I work with. And I think that's most important, to be sure that these buildings are there in perpetuity. From that, you know, there's just an enormous amount of day-to-day work to operate, maintain, and build for the future for the Congress and the Library of Congress and the Supreme Court.
So, Stephen, how did you get into this line of work? I mean, what made you want this job?
Oh, that's interesting. You know, I've been a public architect for 29 years. And, you know, as far as public architects go, this gig is the top. It doesn't get any better than this.
So what exactly is a public architect?
So I'm an architect by trade. I'm a licensed architect. And when I got out of architecture school, I went into the military. And as I was serving in the military, I was an architect working as an architect in the public versus in the private sector designing commercial office buildings or residences for people. I was working in the public sector designing military family housing and military office buildings and aircraft hangars and things like that. And from there, I moved to the Voice of America and the State Department and moved overseas and lived in Greece for 6 years.
And talk about architecture.
Not bad.
Yeah.
Well, it's a little crumbling, isn't it?
They need Stephen over there to fix it.
Exactly, yes. I need
That's
to go back.
Job,
That's
huh?
exactly what I need to do.
They need some support going on.
I lived on the island of Rhodes for 6 years and traveled around Europe doing work for the Voice of America and the State Department. And 18 years ago, at that time, I was looking to come back stateside. My family and I wanted to come back stateside, and I saw a job announcement at the Architect of the Capitol and applied. I had a telephone interview, and I was hired off a telephone interview to come work as a project architect with the Architect of the Capitol, and that was 18 years ago, and I've worked my way up to the top since then.
That is so cool. See, there really are success stories. Well, you know, we never realized that the Architect of the Capitol is actually nominated by the president and confirmed by the Senate. I mean, that's a pretty big deal. So, you know, how did you feel when you were before the Senate and you got the phone call from the president?
Well, usually the phone call doesn't come from the president himself. It's, you know, it's the White House personnel office that makes that.
Oh, close
first,
enough.
First phone call. And
you can embellish here.
Yeah, just
the radio.
We won't tell. Fingers crossed. Fingers crossed.
But it was unanimous, we heard.
Yes, absolutely. That was what an honor, you know, for me. It's a job that I never dreamed of holding, never dreamed and thought I would be nominated by the president and confirmed by the Senate and be able to work with the leaders of our country day in and day out. It's quite a humbling experience and quite an honor, obviously.
Well, Stephen, of course, you know, security is a huge issue these days. How involved do you get in the security issues surrounding the Capitol and the buildings? I can't even imagine what it's like during a State of the Union address, what that must, the pressure that you're under.
Well, let me offer two perspectives on that. So certainly from a security perspective, the physical security of the series of buildings for which I'm responsible for, integrating new security technology into historic buildings is really one of our challenges that we face every day. So that's an important part of our work. But also, you know, one of my responsibilities with the House and Senate Sergeants at Arms and myself, the three of us make up the Capitol Police Board that oversees the police department of 1,700 sworn officers and several hundred civilians. So we're ultimately responsible for the policing and security and continuity operations of the Congress. And that is quite an enormous responsibility and a great deal of work. And it does get a little pressure sometimes.
So which president actually nominated you?
President Obama did.
Okay, so do you serve just under his term? Then do you have to be reappointed with the next president?
No, the architect of the Capitol serves a 10-year appointment.
Oh.
So it's not a political appointment. You know, the president, when I went through the nomination process, no one even asked me whether I was a Republican or a Democrat or an independent. It really doesn't matter.
Boy, that's really cool. Did you ever have to go to, like, school with your kids or anything? I'm assuming maybe you have kids. And what did your daddy do? Well, my dad, he runs the Capitol.
I do have two children, one 26-year-old and a 25-year-old, two wonderful children. A daughter that's 26 that's in Boston now, and my son is at home with me, and he's 25.
Ooh. Well, congratulations.
Both of them recently out of college.
Yay.
So.
Well, that's congrats.
You've made it in life then.
You've made it in life.
We hear you.
We're speaking with Stephen Ayers, architect of the Capitol, who is only the 11th person to hold that job in the Capitol's 220-year history. So, Stephen, let me ask about your budget. First of all, how big is it?
Our budget's about $625 million a year.
That's a lot of money. How much of that goes towards just maintaining and preserving the Capitol? And I would imagine it would be a hefty sum, you know, given the size and the age.
So generally speaking, our budget, about $400 million goes to the day-to-day operation of paying employees salaries and benefits and doing all the day-to-day maintenance of the buildings. And then $200 million of that goes into projects or upgrades or refurbishments or new construction.
And how about integrating technology into a 220-year-old building? I can only imagine that must be a little challenging.
It certainly is, you know, from security features that we spoke of earlier, whether it's cameras or motion detectors and things like that, to wet pipe fire sprinkler systems and smoke detection systems, computer cabling and cell phone antennas, and integrating all of that into these beautiful historic buildings and doing it in a way that you can't see it is the challenge that we face every day. But we have a team of designers and craftsmen that are unbelievably good at what they do, at hiding those things and finding ways to integrate those kinds of technologies in our old buildings that just people marvel at.
So you have Wi-Fi at the Capitol?
We do have Wi-Fi.
Well, if we go get our cup of coffee and we bring our little computers, we can
check
just sit
our
there
emails?
And work, you know,
absolutely.
In the hallway, in the Monuments Hall
right,
or something.
Right. Do you have a favorite spot in the Capitol? Can you let us in on where that is?
Well, I'm not sure I could get it down to one, but let me tell you some of my favorite spots. Certainly one is the old Senate chamber where I was sworn in by Chief Justice John Roberts. And it's just a beautiful place designed by Benjamin Henry Latrobe, one of my predecessors. Late at night, certainly the rotunda, when it's quiet and no one is there, it's very peaceful. And that's a wonderful place just to sit on a bench for 10 minutes and think about the folks that have walked through that space for the 200 and some years preceding you is really a fun thing to do. The president's room on the Senate side of the Capitol, just off the Senate chamber, is a beautifully decorated and ornate place that many presidents over the course of history have signed important legislation.
I always think it's cool to ride the train between the Capitol and the buildings. It's always kind of a neat ride, so to speak. Tell us just a little bit about the first architect of the Capitol, Dr. William Thornton.
Well, he was an amateur architect, you know, and a physician, and he lived in the British Virgin Islands, and interestingly enough, submitted a design for the Capitol after the design competition had closed. The commissioners at that time sought architects to send in their design competitions. Many of them did, and President Washington rejected all of them, and the competition was closed. And then they received a letter from him and said, I'd really like to submit a design and my thoughts for what the Capitol might be like. And would you be willing to receive that? And the president said yes, and he submitted that design, and it was a hit. Wow. Right from
and
that
there
point on.
And there we are.
The rest is history, yeah. As they say.
That's right.
Well, Stephen, you know, clearly you've reached the pinnacle in your career as an architect. So what does a former architect of the Capitol do after the term is over? What are your plans?
Play golf, maybe?
Oh!
I look forward to spending some time at home, a little less time on the road, playing a little golf.
Designing houses?
Yeah.
Or perhaps designing houses?
Maybe putting a dome over your house or your neighbors.
And you never can tell. You know, that's 6 years away. You just can't tell what
that's
life will
right.
be like.
You
in
never
six
know.
Years.
Oh, you're
life
way too young
you.
To retire.
Well, Stephen Ayers, only the 11th architect of the Capitol in its 220-year history. This has been an honor and a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining the Two Boomer Babes.
Thank you.
Did you ever enter a contest hoping to win $7,000 a week, a vacation in Tahiti, or maybe groceries for a year? Well, our next guest entered a contest sponsored by AARP Colorado, with the prize being, get this, 16 weeks of personal training and paid entry to a half marathon.
While it may not seem as exciting as winning a boatload of cash, it certainly is healthier, and winning this contest has been a life changer. Richard Myers was a programmer and IT manager for 38 years and tells us that his career was, and I quote, great for mental exercise, but somewhat lacking in the realm of physical exertion. Richard Myers joins us in our studios with his wife, Vickers, to share his story and how you can do it too. Welcome, guys.
Thanks for having us on the show.
Great to have you. So, Richard, what enticed you to enter this contest?
We subscribe to the ARP newsletter, and that monthly magazine, and it had an entry in it where you could subscribe to your local, in our case, state of Colorado, email. And every day we get news, and it had a notification of this contest that, as you said, if you won it, you got 16 weeks of a personal trainer that came to your house.
Yippee! I mean, I'd be excited if it was 16 weeks of chocolate.
Or maybe the $7,000, too.
Yes.
Exactly. So why do you think you actually won? What did you do?
I think most of the applicants, my surmise, is that they all wrote stories about how their car wouldn't start and they were missing a mortgage payment and they needed this. And it was very serious. So I thought, perhaps the way to go would be the exact opposite.
So what did you do?
I made a character, which is me, since I'm rather rotund, called Blimp Man. And so the entry essay was of the fight between Blimp Man and his arch villains, Comfy Recliner Guy, Big Screen TV Man, and so forth.
And Dorito Boy.
And Dorito Boy. I like that. A henchman.
All right. So, Richard, how has this changed your life? I mean, how often are you working with a trainer? And are you actually eating less because of this? No more Doritos?
No more Doritos. Yes, I'm fortunate enough that I'm working out with her twice a week.
Ooh.
And I'm running four times a week and doing other exercises. And I've changed what I'm eating also. And the combination of those two has just been wonderful, down two whole pant sizes already.
Wow, that's
something.
That's good. Well, Vickers, so we want to ask you about this. I saw a photo that was so sweet, and you were actually measuring Richard's waistline. And so, you know, obviously you're his sort of support backup. So how have you been helping him?
First of all, I'm cooking healthy meals. And then I have been recording him and his trainer, Julie, And so he has those exercises that he can see on video so he can repeat them during the week without her there. And I'm also out walking with him.
So how have your meals changed? You say you're making healthy meals. I mean, how? Just give us an example.
I'm making low-cal, low-fat, but tasty meals. And we're trying to eat six small meals a day instead of three large meals a day.
Ooh. Okay, so like what is exactly are you, like, are you making fish? Are you making like broiled chicken?
It's like the Mediterranean diet.
Oh, I love the Mediterranean. So, yeah, healthy like feta cheese and,
right.
and nuts and mm-hmm. what else? Olives.
More protein
like that.
And good oils for you.
And not a lot of desserts.
And not a lot of desserts.
Gets you every time, doesn't it? Well, Richard, we understand that you write a blog and you use your name.
Your alias.
Limp Man.
Yes.
And you are very funny, clearly, and very candid. But I have to say, you know, you're looking rather svelte. I mean, are you thinking of changing the name of your blog anytime soon?
I can't think of any other mode of locomotion that might be appropriate that's a little smaller than a blimp. Balloon Man doesn't sound quite right. So I think we'll stick with Blimp Man for a while longer.
Well, it has a certain panache, doesn't it?
It does.
Right. Tell us exactly the name of your blog.
Blimp Man's blog, Running the Distance.
Ooh, love
oh,
it. Love
so
it.
If we actually Google that on the AARP.org website, it'll pop up.
In fact, if you just Google Blimp Man, nothing else, just the word Blimp Man with no space, it'll be the first thing that pops up.
I bet they're not too many. See, you're the one. You're heading out there. So finally, what message do you really want to send to others?
Don't give up. If a person that starts off at 272 pounds, who can't run more than half a block unless being chased by a dog, can get to the point that just in a few weeks, running 3 miles without stopping, anything is possible. It truly is.
Oh, that's impressive. Well, Richard Myers, AARP contest winner, Blimp Man blog author, and Vicar Myers, your amazing behind-the-scenes support system, you two are very inspiring. Best of luck with a half marathon, and we babes can't wait until you cross that finish line.
Thanks so much.
And now it's time for us babes to give credit where credit is due.
Audio and technical guru Julio Gonzalez, who magically pulls it all together.
Webmaster wizard Gail Jane, who makes TwoBoomerBabes.com a fab place to visit.
Founding members of the Chicago chapter of the Two Boomer Babes Supper Club, Mike and Larry Israel, for your unfailing love and support.
Our husbands, daughters, family, and friends, even with smirks and eye rolls, who encourage us all the way.
And give us great material, often without knowing it.
Our moms and upstairs directors, Jane and Sally, who are cheering us on from their bridge game in the sky.
Our home away from home, Delmarva Public Radio. And to you, our listeners, for joining us each week and spurring us on.
Two Boomer Babes is a production of Two Boomer Babes Media in collaboration with Zymer Communications.